Yeah, I just wanted to go back a little bit, in Parshas Lech Lecha, we'll connect it to the present Parsha. So after Avraham Avinu asks Hashem that, what is the use of all of the blessings that you've given me if I will be ariri, if I will be without children? So Avraham Avinu actually had a havamina that he would have no children. This is even before the birth of Yishmael. And the question is, how could Avraham Avinu possibly think he would not have children if HaKadosh Baruch Hu already told him, when he commanded him to come to Eretz Yisrael, he said, V'escha l'goy gadol, I will make you into a great nation. Well, what did Avraham Avinu think? Did Avraham Avinu think that Hashem's promise would not be kept? There already was a promise. So what was the havamina that it would not be mekuyam, that he says to Hashem, what is the use of my life if I am hariri, if I am without children? So there are really three mahalchim, you could say, to this question. Mahalach number one is that it does not represent, the question does not represent a lack of emunah. It is simply almost a cry of anguish and impatience, meaning to say, okay, when is it going to happen? Which is still not the greatest thing, but it's not a taina that, you know, you're not going to give it to me, but when is it going to happen? But there's another teres, and here you have to be ma'ayin very carefully in the chronology. In other words, what was my question? My question is, how could Avraham Avinu say, how could I be without children if Hashem already said, V'escha l'goy gadol, I'll make you a great nation? Now, the question is presupposing that the Torah is written in chronological order and the promises of Lech Lecha were already made before the Bris Ben Absarim, the covenant of the parts, which is when Hashem answered that question. In reality, if you look at the various Rashis and Chumash, they're not all here in Lech Lecha chronologically, you see the very, very amazing thing that Lech Lecha is not Avraham Avinu's first trip to the land of Israel, but he had made an earlier trip, and this Bris Ben Absarim occurred earlier, 5 years earlier, than the Havtacha of Lech Lecha. How do we get all this? We get all this in a kind of a roundabout way, because there are three different numbers that the Torah uses for the duration of the years the Jewish people were in Mitzrayim. Three different numbers. One number is the very famous 210 years, that from the time the Jewish people came to Mitzrayim till the time that they were redeemed from Mitzrayim was 210 years. By the way, that doesn't mean they were slaves for that time, because remember, that includes Yosef, that includes many, many years where they were not slaves, but from the time Yaakov Avinu came to Mitzrayim, when he heard that Yosef was alive, until Moshe Rabbeinu took them out of Mitzrayim, was 210 years, and there's a remez to this, because Hashem told Yaakov, Redu, go down to Mitzrayim. The gematria of Redu is Resh Dalet Vav, 200, 4, and 6, that's 210. That is one number. There's another number at the Bris Ben Absarim, when Hashem told Avraham, your children will be as strangers and enslaved in a land that is not theirs for 400 years. Okay? And then there's yet a third number. When the Jews are actually taken out of Mitzrayim, it says this spans a duration of 430 years. So we have a three-way contradiction. Was it 210? Was it 400? Was it 430? Now there are different answers to this. I'm just going to go with Rashi's answers, which are based on Chazal. Rashi says like this. Certainly, the duration of the Jewish people's stay in Mitzrayim was 210 years. Where do you get 400 years? It was 400 years from the time Yitzchak Avinu was born. Because remember, the Pasuk does not say your children will be enslaved in Egypt for 400 years. It says they will be persecuted and enslaved in a land that is not theirs. And even Yitzchak himself, in Eretz Yisrael, was harassed, was pushed around, his wells were filled up. So it was 400 years from the birth of Yitzchak. Okay? Now, where do you get the 430? So Rashi says in Parshas Bo, it was 430 years from the Bris Ben Absarim when Avraham was told of this exile. So according to Rashi, the Bris Bein Absharim occurred 30 years before the birth of Yitzchak. Because it's 400 years from the birth of Yitzchak, it's 430 from the Bris Bein Absharim. So the Bris Bein Absharim occurred 30 years before the birth of Yitzchak. Now, let's figure this out. We know for sure from the Chumash that Avram was 100 years old when Yitzchak was born. So how old was Avram at the Bris Bein Absharim if that was 30 years before the birth of Yitzchak? Avram was 70 years old. But wait a second. Parshas Lech Lecha begins that Avram came to the land of Canaan when he was 75 years old. See, so you actually can prove, you know, mathematically, that the Bris Bein Absharim, the covenant of the parts, when Avram was told about this slavery, and when he asked Hashem, what is the purpose of my life if I don't have a child, that occurred 5 years before Lech Lecha. In other words, this is, and again, the Ramban explains this, the Rashi does not explain all of this, but the Ramban is Marech, and the Ramban explains that 5 years before Hashem told him to go to the land of Canaan, he went on his own. He was drawn like a magnet to the holiness of the land. And there was a covenant already then. He then went back to Haran, where Terach died, and 5 years later, Hashem said, now is the time to go permanently. So the whole question doesn't start off with, because I asked the question, how could he ask Hashem, what is the use of my life without children, if Hashem already told him, Eschel Goy Gadol? Hashem didn't tell him, I will make you a good, great nation, until he was 75 years old. At the time of the Bris Bein Absharim, he actually didn't know yet. That was the first time. That's the second answer. And again, that's an important thing to realize, that Avraham Avinu had a whole prior trip, like they call it a pilot trip. That's what they, when you make Aliyah, Nefesh B'Nefesh tells you to make a pilot trip. So he actually made a pilot trip on his own. It's fascinating. Hashem didn't tell him to go. But a person feels in his heart, he wants to be connected to holiness, to Kedusha. And this is Avraham Avinu. And this is what brought him to the land of Canaan, Eretz Yisrael, but at that point it was called the land of Canaan. So that's a second reason why he could be in doubt whether he would have the children. There's a third answer as well. And that is, we know that already in Haran, from the time Avraham Avinu was in his 40s, Avraham Avinu was actively involved. The Gemara's lashon is he was actively involved in Gerim. Right? It says Avraham converted the men, and Sarah converted the women. This is the nefesh. This is what the Torah means when it says the souls that they had made in Haran. Don't confuse Haran with Haran. Don't confuse them. Haran is a place. Haran is the name of one of Abraham's brothers who died in the fiery furnace, and Haran is the father of Sarah and Lot. That's Haran. Haran is a place in Mesopotamia and the like. That's where Laban is. That's where a lot of the family is, because the family left Ur Kasdim. Imagine, like, you have to, if you imagine from your middle school years, the Fertile Crescent. So Ur Kasdim is at the base of the crescent, and Haran is near the top of the crescent. And when you go southwest, you're going to Eretz Yisrael, and Haran is where Terach and Avram went, and Terach died, but a lot of Terach's family was left there. Nochor, and Nochor had a child, Besuel. Besuel had Laban and Rivka, etc. Right, that was the family in Haran. That's where Eliezer goes to find a wife for Yitzchak. That is where Yaakov goes and works for Laban for 20 years. That's in Haran. But Avram and Sarah had nefesh. They had a nefesh, souls that they had made in Haran. By the way, what is the Pashuk Pshat of the Pasuk without the Drasha? So if you look at Targum Unglas, Es HaNefesh Esher Asu B'Haran literally just means the slaves that they purchased in Haran. It doesn't refer to anything more than that. But Chazal Darshan, HaNefesh, they made souls to God. Now when it says they converted, what do you mean they converted? It doesn't mean they became Jewish. It means that they converted to the Noahide laws, to believe in Hashem, right? Avraham Avinu and Sarah were the great people who spread the name of Hashem in the world. So Chazal say that when you bring a person to Torah, when you bring a person to God, it is as if you have given birth to them. So Avraham Avinu might have thought, he's getting old, and he doesn't have children, but he knows Hashem promised him, from you I will make a great nation. Avraham might think, well, perhaps Hashem is going to fulfill his promise to me via all of the nefashos that I made that are spiritually considered my children. Do you know to this very day, you know, that every ger is officially called up to the Torah as Ben Avraham, a child of Avraham? We have heterim, for example, if not to embarrass, he could be called up by his biological, let's say a person has a Jewish father and a non-Jewish mother. So technically he had to convert. Technically he is a ger, and he would not legally be called up by his biological Jewish father's name, but in order to spare embarrassment, we, you know, we're very, very lenient in that. But technically in a ketubah, in a get, where you have to be exact in names, a ger is referred to as Ben Avram. By the way, this is not relevant to the opposite shaila. People sometimes ask the shaila, what if I have a Jewish mother and a non-Jewish father? A Jewish mother and a non-Jewish father, how am I called up to the Torah? See, if I have a non-Jewish mother and a Jewish father, halachically, I should be called up Ben Avraham, because I'm a ger. But in order not to embarrass, we are allowed to go with the name of the Jewish father. But the other way is very different. The other way is when you have a Jewish mother and a non-Jewish father, you're not a ger, you're a born Jew. Now, some people, I think, mistakenly say, well, since the father is not Jewish, we call you Ben Avraham. But that really doesn't make any particular sense. You're a Jew. So there we do have a few opinions. Opinion number one is, you actually call him up by the name of the mother. Of course, that would be an issue of embarrassment. Meaning, if the mother's name is Miriam, he would be called up to the Torah, Moshe ben Miriam, which, you know, might be a little conspicuous. Others say, you can use the name of the mother's father. If the mother is Jewish, you call up the child by the name of his grandfather, his mother's father, his maternal grandfather, based on the idea, b'nei banim harei hein kebanim, grandchildren are like children. You can do that. Others do say Ben Avraham, but I think that's a very weak psat. Because Ben Avraham is what you use for Gerim. You don't use it for Jewish people, although in a sense we're all Bnei Avraham, but you don't use Ben Avraham automatically for a Jewish person. Okay. But be it as it may, therefore, when Avraham says, what is the use if I don't have children? So the question is, what is his Hava Amina? Didn't Hashem promise him children? The answer is he thinks maybe Hashem is going to fulfill his promise through the Gerim, but Avraham is not happy with that. And the reason is, because many of those Gerim seem to have disappeared from history. It's very, very interesting. Avraham, apparently, was Megayer many, 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 many people. But it didn't last. And indeed, in the Sifrei Kabbalah, there's a description that, you know, Avraham represents the idea of kindness, expansion, chesed. Yitzchak represents din. Din is connected to introspection, discipline, and withdrawal. And chesed is a wonderful, wonderful thing. But chesed can sometimes dissipate, because chesed is so generous. It gives, it gives, it gives, it gives. But there is no discipline, there is no structure. So Avraham was able to attract people to Judaism, because, you know, Avraham showed them kindness. It was a wonderful religion, you know, kindness, goodness, singing, dancing, you know, we don't know exactly what form. And that could last for a while. But the downside of that is that when people realize there's also responsibilities, they move away. So it's actually brought down tragically. All of the nefesh asher asu b'charan, they eventually dropped on the side. I told the story, I think, on Simchas Torah, of the Russian convert, the guy, who was a drunken peasant. And he converted to Judaism because he liked the way Hasidim were rejoicing. So he had a really, really good time. Because he converted around Rosh Chodesh Shvat. So it was really wonderful, because Rosh Chodesh, big party with a lot of vodka. 2 weeks later, Tu B'Shvat. 2 weeks later, Rosh Chodesh Ador. 2 weeks later, Purim. You know, great. And of course, there's Shabbos in between. 2 weeks later, you know, it's already, it's Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Then Pesach, wonderful, you know, everything's a party, a celebration, drinking, dancing. So he tells his friend that you have to convert to Judaism. This is such a wonderful religion, so much fun. So his friend took a little while before he converted, but his friend converted like after Shivas or Batamos. So he gets hit with the 3 weeks and the 9 days. So he says, you know, what's going on? And then Rosh Hashanah even is hard because, you know, you daven, you know, till 4 o'clock in the afternoon, then Yom Kippur. You know, what is all this? Okay, he didn't hold out the Sukkot, but he's already, you know, he... So he goes over to the guy and says, I thought you told me this religion is full of fun and games and everybody have parties all the time. I just come in, I can't eat meat and I can't, you know, can't go to a wedding and what's going on? No wine. So the person scratches his head and says, I don't know, ever since you joined, you've been going downhill. I don't know what happened. What happened? But that's the thing, that in a way, one has to understand that Avodas Hashem has, of course, it should give a person in life a deep joy and a deep fulfillment. But there's also responsibilities and there are tasks and, you know, one has to assume those obligations. And the downside of chesed is chesed can bring a lot of people in, but it may not have the staying power because people don't have a sense of responsibility and obligation. And this was a bit of a tragedy in Avraham Avinu's life, that all of the thousands and thousands of people that he brought to Hashem, they eventually dropped it. And this is why he's crying, what is the use of my life if I go childless? Because even if all of my Talmidim were my children, my Talmidim have left me. And Hashem therefore have to reassure him, you will have one disciple from whom the Jewish people will come, that's Yitzchak, and they will not leave you, they will be with you. They will be with you all the time. So we have this covenant of the parts, the Bris Ben Absarim, in which the different animals were cut. And Hashem made a covenant with Abraham, but that covenant is a very scary covenant, right? There's darkness, the whole scene. There's darkness. Abraham feels exhausted. He feels he needs to sleep because Hashem is showing him that the bris is not without cost. The bris will have suffering. It will have galus. It will have avdus, slavery, persecution, and all of this. Now, there are different statements in Chazal that say that all of this was actually a punishment to Avraham because he asked Hashem the question after Hashem promised him the land and promised him children. He said to Hashem, how do I know that this will happen? And that's when Hashem said, cut up the animals. So Rashi brings the Gemara in Nedarim that because Avraham Avinu lacked emuna in Hashem's promise, all of these punishments come to pass. The Maral says that's very, very difficult. Because if you look at the Torah itself, it seems very, very clear that the slavery in Egypt was not a punishment to Avraham. It was a punishment, if at all, for the sale of Yosef and the behavior of the Shvatim. It doesn't go back to Avraham. So the Maral in the Gur Aryeh learns that when Chazal say it was a punishment to Avraham, Chazal don't mean the slavery was a punishment to Avraham. Chazal mean Avraham being told of the slavery was a punishment to Avraham. The slavery would have happened because there were separate reasons for it, but Hashem wouldn't have told Avraham, except as a little bit of Musar and a little bit of punishment. Okay. Now, in the Bris Ben Absarim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, your children, now look at the language here, ki ger yiyeh zaracha yeretz lo lahem, your seed will be a ger. Ger means a stranger in a land that is not theirs. V'yavadum, and they will work as slaves. V'inu osam, and they will be afflicted. Arba me'oshana, 400 years from the birth of Yitzchak. But the nation that enslaves them, Dan Anochi, I will judge, I will punish. V'yachareichem, and afterwards, Yetzu, your children shall leave, Birchush Gadol, with great wealth. So this is a very rich pasuk. It really tells you a lot. But those of us that already know the rest of the story, we know everything that's built into here. There's going to be three stages. First, they will be strangers, aliens. then they will be slaves, and then there'll be actual physical persecution, like throwing babies into the water. And then we know there will be punishments. That punishment is the 10 plagues and the death of the splitting of the Red Sea, etc. The deaths at the splitting of the Red Sea. And then there's going to be rechush gadol, great wealth. Now, what is this promise of great wealth? So on one level, you'll recall that when the Jews left Mitzrayim, they took with them gold and silver. At the Yom Suf, they took even more gold and silver. But Chazal actually say the true great wealth is the Torah that they got at Sinai. That is the great, great wealth, that they will be given the Torah as a result of their purification. So this passage in the Bris Bein Ha-Bsarim, the Rambam uses in Hilchos Tshuva to raise some very, very fundamental and important questions. And that is, the Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva talks about the all-important principle that in our Sameach we talk about all the time, everybody talks about all the time, free will, Bechira, that Judaism is axiomatic in Judaism, that Hashem does not decree on a person that they will be evil or they will be good. Every human being has free will. And this is the meaning of the statement in Chazal, Hakol bidei shamayim. Everything is decreed by Hashem, whether you're wealthy, rich, poor, healthy, sick, that comes from Hashem. But the one thing that Hashem does not decree is your Yiras Shemayim, whether you will keep the mitzvahs and listen to God or not. That's not God. That's you. That's us. I remember my Rosh Hashiva at the beginning of his man, he would ask a bachur, are you going to learn well with Saman? So a bachur would say, Emir Hashem, if God wills, I will learn well. So he would say, that's not the right answer. Of course Hashem wants you to learn well. What do you think? He doesn't? The question of whether you learn well is not does Hashem want you to learn well. It's whether you want to learn well. So it's not Emir Tzah Hashem. It's Im Tirtzah Atah. Hakol bidei shamayim chutz miyirah shamayim. Right? So the Rambam says that Bechira, free will, as opposed to determinism, I mean, it raises a lot of questions. I mean, there are a lot of questions. Just in the abstract, the Rambam raises several questions. First of all, free will seems to contradict divine omniscience. By omniscience, that simply means Hashem knows the future. Right? So this is a famous old question, but it's, you know, it's a good question. And that is, Hashem knows what I'm going to do tomorrow. Hashem knows what I'm going to do tomorrow. He knew that, you know, 1,000 years ago. So Hashem knows if I'm going to daven tomorrow or not going to daven. He knows if I'm going to learn or not going to learn. So how can it be said that when I wake up in the morning, I have the choice to daven or not? If I choose contrary to what God already knows, then that means God didn't know, and that's impossible. And if God already knows, then by the time I make my choice, I don't have a choice. The choice has already been made. Right, so that's a basic question. Is free will a contradiction to divine knowledge of the future? So the Rambam gives a complicated answer, but essentially, to put it in the most simplest way, it is not, because this would only be true in a temporal sense. In other words, if the future hasn't happened yet, but before it happens, I know, then there's no choice. But from God's perspective, God is existing above time. So from God's perspective, past, present, and future are all in the concurrent moment. Now, the same way, for example, if I see you davening, I know you're davening, but I'm not affecting your choice. I just know what you're doing, but my knowledge of what you're doing is not making the choice. So God's knowledge of the future is equivalent to my knowledge of the present. God is not decreeing that I will behave a certain way. God is just seeing my behavior from the vantage point of someone that is above time. Right? He's above time, so it's as if past, present, future are just stages that you move into. So God is simply seeing you from a higher perspective. And therefore the Rambam argues that that is not a contradiction to free will. God is seeing as a present reality the choices that you're deciding to make. Okay, now this is the Rambam's idea. It's only if it hadn't happened yet, we would say, that my knowledge of the future precludes free will, but not if God is seeing it in the concurrent moment. Yeah?
So that means that everything we did has already happened. Our decisions have been already made.
But it's been made by you. In other words, the issue becomes, it's hard for us to articulate this because we don't understand exactly. We say the words. We don't really understand what it means to be in a framework above time. But in a sense, time is linear in almost a spatial way, meaning to say everything has already happened, so to speak, but it just hasn't been revealed. It's like a turntable or a turnstile behind the stage in which all the sets are there and the turnstile is simply turning, but the ultimate decision was the person's decision. Now, the truth is this is an abstract idea, and the Ravid, who is the famous Rishon who argues with the Rambam, the Ravid is very annoyed at the Rambam because he says to the Rambam, if you can't give an answer that people can understand, you shouldn't have asked the question to begin with, and therefore. The Ravid has another approach. The Ravid is a very fascinating approach, which some people would say is not an acceptable approach. He says like this. He says that God's knowledge of the future is in the nature of predictive accuracy. For example, let's say your mother serves you, gives you a, your mother serves you a choice of ice cream. You can have either chocolate or vanilla. But she knows from the years and years of past experience that you like vanilla. So she knows you're going to choose vanilla. Did she make you choose vanilla? No, you have the freedom. But because she knows you, she can predict at a very high degree of accuracy what your choice is going to be. So the Ravid says, God's knowledge of the future is in the nature of prediction, but because Hashem knows you so well, it is prediction with an accuracy rate of 100%, but it is predictive accuracy, meaning, according to the Ravid, Hashem's knowledge of the future is of the same nature as your mother knowing you're going to choose vanilla ice cream. Your mother is not making the choice for you. Your mother is not foreclosing your ability to surprise her by picking chocolate. But she can predict. Hashem can predict. But statistically, Hashem's prediction... Now, the question is it always going to be 100%? I mean, is the Ravid saying there's a possibility that maybe a one in a quadrillion chance that God would get it wrong? It's not so clear. And of course, that raises another philosophical question, because if you're telling me that because God knows me, I mean, this really, in a way, the Ravid painted himself into a difficult corner. Because if the Ravid is saying the reason God knows the future is simply because since God knows every single thing about your past, he can predict with 100% accuracy what you're going to choose, then wait a second. That itself destroys free will, because that itself says every choice I make is a consequence of, that's exactly what a behaviorist psychologist says. That if, in other words, what the Ravid says is what psychology says. Psychology says, if we would know every single thing that ever happened to you from the beginning of your life and maybe preconception till now, and nobody could ever know that, we would be able to predict like a machine how you're going to behave. Now, l'chaira, b'chira itself is a rejection of that. I mean, the problem is, if the Ravid seems to be predicating God's knowledge of the future on God's perfect knowledge of the past, which gives him the capacity of 100% accurate prediction. But that gufa is a contradiction to b'chira, because that suggests that whatever that your past dictates and compels your future decisions, when in fact Bechira specifically says that's not the case. So one has to be mind. On one hand, the Ravid's teretz is a very simple teretz, that God simply knows the future the way mom knows you're going to pick vanilla. On the other hand, if you take the Ravid a little further, you have a frontal attack on the very concept of Bechira.
I want to say that I read in like Guy Kaplan's book, he explains it as a chess playing example. He says, think about a computer who knows master computer level. You put it on master so that it knows every move you make. It knows like 10 moves ahead even. So whatever move you make, it'll have a counter move towards your move. So he says in that regard, even when you're trying to play against the master chess player, in this case it would be God, the conductor of the universe, whatever move you make, he knows the counter move for it. So no matter what move you make, you know, in a sense, it's a part of
okay,
it.
Okay, I hear what you're saying. What you're saying is 100% correct, but I would suggest the following. I would suggest that what Rabbi Kaplan is referring to is a different question. He's not addressing this question per se. He's addressing the question of how does free will intersect with God's divine plan? Because God has a plan for the universe. And yet, God's plan depends on trillions of people making decisions over which God does not exercise control. So Rabbi Kaplan is addressing a different, it's not my question, he's addressing the question of how can God carry out a plan if these billion, trillion people are making decisions on their own? And he says that's the metaphor of the chess master, that God has a counter move. But I'm asking a question one level higher, and that is we were asking the question as to how do people have this free will if God knows exactly what they're going to choose? In other words, that's a different question. The issue of Rabbi Kaplan's point is actually a very excellent point. And by the way, I don't want to get too involved in areas that I am very, very far from an expert in. But this metaphor of the chess player is an excellent, excellent metaphor, and it's borne out in more advanced physics. You know, we have two systems of physics that work simultaneously. We have what are called Newtonian physics, which is called classical physics, and that is a deterministic system. By that we mean to say a given stimulus will always produce a certain result. Force applied to an object, if all conditions are equal, it'll always be the same. And that's the basis of scientific laws, the notion of a certain predictability of cause and effect. That's called Newtonian physics. It is called a deterministic system, that force applied to an object, if all conditions are equal, will always produce the same thing. Now, in the late 19th and early 20th century, when the atom was discovered and we analyzed subatomic particles, it was discovered at the subatomic level. This is not true. There seems to be randomness and chaos that is going on. If a particle is hit, sometimes it behaves this way, sometimes it behaves that way, sometimes it does this, sometimes it does this. And this was the whole development of a field that Einstein initially pioneered, he eventually repudiated, called quantum mechanics. Niels Bohr, these are like the Gedolim in physics. It's a great thing. Now, which is right? Do I say that there's randomness, chaos, indeterminacy? Or do I say deterministic? So what a physicist will tell you is they're both right, and that is Newtonian physics continues to govern big things. Tables, chairs, computers, cars, jet engines. And that's why you take a flight. You know, you wouldn't want to take a flight if an airplane is predicated on quantum mechanics, because that's like saying, well, maybe this time, you know, it'll go up, and you know, next time it'll just won't. The whole idea of life generally depends on predictability and stability, but they tell you on the subatomic level, everything is chaotic. Now, l'chora, that makes no sense at all, because big things are made up of little things. So how can it be that if the little subatomic particles are meshuggah and they're running around and doing their own thing, somehow on the aggregate macro level, it all works out? The answer is exactly this. This is the paradox of God's plan for the world coupled with human free will. We are like the little subatomic particles, meaning we make billions of little choices like chickens without heads, and God does not dictate those choices whatsoever. But whatever choices are made are coordinated in a framework where Hashem's plan gets carried out. It's a remarkable thing that in the deep structure of the physical universe, this conflict is played out between individual, non-predictive autonomy and ultimate structure and order and harmony. And that's kind of the analogy of the chess master. Okay. So one question, again, we'll have to hold this off to continue. So one question the Rambam addresses, again, there are going to be three questions altogether. Question number one is the contradiction between free will and God's knowledge of the future, and on that we have the answer of the Rambam, that God is above time, so he simply sees things as they are happening. We have the Ravid, which is very problematic, in which God's knowledge of the future is predictive accuracy, like mom knowing you're going to choose vanilla ice cream. Then the Rambam asks another question. So now we have question number two of the Rambam, which is not a difficult question. He answers that this is easier to understand, and that is, in addition to God being omniscient, he knows the future, God is omnipotent. Right? You know the difference in the two words. Omniscience is God's knowledge of the future. Omnipotent is God's infinite power. Right? You can know something and not have power. God is both omniscient and omnipotent. So here, the Rambam raises the question, but again, it's not really a question. He'll say it himself. How can I say that I have free will? Doesn't that mean that God is lacking power over me? In other words, how can I do something against God? Isn't that a contradiction to God's omnipotence? So here Maimonides says, it obviously is not, because the decision to give me that freedom was made by God. It's not an inherent limitation on God that God can't stop me from sinning. God has chosen not to exercise his power to control me in that area. So consequently, if a person chooses not to exercise his power, there is no intimation that he doesn't have that power. He has chosen not to exercise it. So Maimonides said, free will is not a contradiction to divine omnipotence, because free will is in itself granted by God, who has decided to abdicate his power. Now, why has God decided to abdicate his power? For a very simple reason, and that is the Rambam and everyone else says this as well. Goodness is truly good only when it is chosen and not when it is compelled. And therefore, if Hashem could have made a world where we had to do good, like a robot, but then, paradoxically, we wouldn't have been good. A person is not good, a computer, for example, that carries out its functions. You might say it works well, but you can't call it virtuous, you can't call it righteous, you can't call it holy. And if it doesn't work, you can't call it evil, although sometimes we have that feeling. Virtue, righteousness, holiness are qualities that are connected with choosing. And since it was the will of God that we become holy, righteous, and virtuous, he had to create a world where we could choose evil. And then when we don't choose evil, we choose good. We are now choosing. In fact, that even goes back to why there's evil in the world. Why do evildoers prosper? Think about it. Let's imagine we had to, if you were God and you were a systems engineer working in heaven, and you wanted to design the perfect rational world. And the perfect rational world would be that whenever you do mitzvos, you get $1 million. Whenever you do averus, you get shot. So let's imagine that you had such a world where the good guys always come out ahead and the bad guys always get punished one way or the other. You could even make it graduated. First offense, 5 volts electric shock. 5 extra volts, you know, for every shock. Let's imagine, you know, people say, we live in a world the righteous suffer. So let's say we had the other type of world. Let's say we had the world where the righteous never suffer and only bad people suffer. The truth of the matter is, that would make a world that is inferior to the world that we have for the following way. I'm sure you've all heard of the Skinner box, right? Skinner? B.F. Skinner was a famous psychologist, behavioral psychologist, and he believed everything was conditioned. So he had a box where a pigeons are pretty dumb, they're not smart. They're not like dogs, you know. There were two levers. One lever, the pigeon gets a shock, and the other lever, it gets a piece of corn. Well, even a dumb pigeon learns after a certain number of times to press the lever on the right and not the lever on the left. If Hashem would have made a moral universe where every time you do something good, you get a prize, our virtue would be nothing better than a dumb pigeon. It wouldn't have meant anything. So in many, many ways, you almost have to create a world where, at least in the short term, bad guys come out ahead, because that ensures that I'm choosing goodness because it's good and not because it's expedient or convenience. To put it another way, evil is kind of a necessary evil. In other words, evil has to exist. You know, in the old Soviet Union, you know, that's the, before Russia, there was the Soviet Union, you may remember. So they went through a pretense, everything, you know, they people had no freedom at all, but ritualistically they had their freedom. So there were always elections, there were annual elections in the Soviet Union, but you only had one candidate on the ballot. You know, there weren't two people, only one guy was running, whoever the Communist Party, you know, nominated. So typically, and then they would make these announcements, so in an outstanding exercise of democracy, this candidate got 98% of the vote, you know, that was cast, you know, amazing, the triumph of democracy, you know, whatever it would be. But what is that? That's not a choice. A choice, you have a choice to do that only one thing. Choice means you have to do both. So Hashem has to make it equally balanced in some way. And that's not a contradiction to God's power, because it was God's own decision to not exercise the power that he could exercise. Yeah.
In the same way we say that God chooses to relinquish some control over
yeah.
us to give us free will,
right.
Why can't we say also that God relinquishes some of his knowledge of the future in order to give us free will too? That he needs to both give us power and also lose some of his own knowledge of the future. That's a choice he made. What's wrong with that approach?
That is a possible approach. I think that. I mean, you're right. I think the reason why people might be a little bit more reluctant is because they want to differentiate between things like knowledge and things like exercising power. Meaning to say, when you say that God closes his eyes, you're suggesting his knowledge is now limited. And that seems to be a little more questionable than saying God chooses not to act. I guess the difference would be ignorance, even if it's self-imposed, is still ignorance, and therefore that would mean God is lacking something, as opposed to not acting is not really the same. But what you're saying is an approach, and again, I've seen Svarim even utilize that as well, that God has self-imposed himself into a universe where he doesn't want to be aware in order to enable free will. Okay. Now, the third question the Rambam raises, I'm going to save for next time, and that's the one that's most relevant to the Parsha, and that is a textual question. And that is, in the Bris Bein Absarim, God decrees that we're going to be enslaved. And yet, God punishes the nation that enslaves us. Now, the Rambam made a very logical argument that without free will, it would be unjust for Hashem to punish you. Meaning, if Hashem made you sin, how could he punish you? So the question is, if God decreed we would be slaves, didn't he effectively make the Egyptians sin, right? So well, how could they be punished? So we'll talk about that later, and we'll talk about the Machlokas, the Rambam and the Ramban, how to learn, what, again, although this comes up in Shmos, but the initial question is in the Bris Bein Absarim, when slavery is decreed, and yet God says, I'm going to punish the wrongdoers. So we'll talk about that next time.